Our question today is a question that has been asked many times and also been answered many times, but apparently it is not enough. So, our dear listener, they ask, why is it that we do not have a female prophet? Why are all of our prophets men? And, in extension, why can't a woman be a religious leader? Like, why can't she be a religious authority, meaning a marja, which men can then take their Islamic rulings from? Is this not considered inequality?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Why we cannot have a woman prophet or female prophet here? Or, for example, why we cannot have the, you know, maybe we can say that Islamic leader cannot be a female.
Right.
You know that what is a prophethood of or leadership, political leadership that we are talking about is, after all, there are kinds of responsibility, not rights. Okay.
Right.
Especially talking about the prophethood is a heaviest responsibility on the shoulders of human being. You know, the human being who has been chosen to be the prophet, that prophet have the heaviest responsibility upon himself, and he wanted to be the prophet of that time. Okay? It means that that individual has all qualification to have a kind of, let's say, divine leadership.
Right.
Okay? And to be among people and to deal with people, preach the message of Islam, political
right.
responsibilities, and so on, a lot of heavy responsibility that really suits for a male, not
right.
all male, qualified male. I mean, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will choose one of the best.
The very best.
Yeah, very right. best people to be a prophet. But really, when you look at the nature of women, for most cases, they cannot be a prophet. And of course, it is not deficiency towards women.
Right.
Rather, it means that they have other qualifications. They suit to be, for example, many other jobs which are suits to their nature.
Right. They have other responsibilities.
Other responsibilities. I want to say that it does not mean at all any deficiency to women that particular woman cannot be judge or cannot be a leader or cannot be prophet. Because after all, if you go to the nature of this responsibility, you find it out to be very difficult. Okay?
Right.
And it is not suit the nature of women to be in that heavy responsibility.
Right.
For example, prophets have to, if the circumstances is ready, they have to establish the, for example, government.
Right.
Okay? And to have some kind of order and to execute laws of Allah subhanahu
right.
wa ta'ala, talking about different prophets.
Yeah, and wage war and battles
wage
and
war,
leadership, military yeah. leadership, all
yes,
of those
you're right.
things.
Yes. And to wage war, sometimes it is necessary, or to defend the territories. And to, you know, these responsibilities, really, even female, they accept that they cannot
right.
have such a responsibility. On the other hand, they can have one of the most suit responsibility according to their nature.
Right. So the difference, it is not in the deficiency, because they are lacking. It is simply because they were not created for this purpose. Is this a correct understanding, dear Sheikh?
Exactly. This is one of the philosophy of why women cannot be a prophet. By the same token, we can have this idea to the leadership. You know,
right.
let's say Islamic leadership, or for example, the judge. Why they cannot be, the Islamic leadership or Islamic leader
right.
or the judge? By the same token, we understand that because judging means to have kind of verdict, and sometimes it is necessary for the jurist, okay, to have and to execute these laws.
They need to be logical, and also they need to, I do not want to say that they need to be stoic and cold-hearted, but they need to also be able to execute these laws.
They have to be, exactly, they have to be firm, strong, and, you know.
Exactly, yes.
Yes, and to, you know, have to have these Islamic laws executed and to give the verdict. And these are, does not suit the nature of woman.
Well, we have said, dear Sheikh, sorry for interrupting you, that men, they are more logical, and women, they are more emotional.
For the most cases, yes, maybe we have the, it is one of the philosophy of that, but female, you know, maybe the, you know, it suits them to have some kind of dealing with the nature, with the nurture of the babies.
Exactly, yes.
And to raise them and to educate them. And these ideas which are more appropriate to the nature of woman. Yes.
Because there's, Sheikh, an extension of what you were saying, a man, he has been created, we can say, for the outside world, like for working outside the house. And I do not say that women should only be in the house. I mean that the men are, they are tasked, responsible for making the society work outside, the logistics, how things work, how things are built, military leadership, and so on and so forth. While the mothers, the women, they are tasked with raising children, with nurturing the future Islamic generation so this Islamic society can continue. Isn't this true, dear Sheikh?
Exactly. For I want to say that for the most cases, because they have very, you know, let's say nice feeling, and they wanted to have the this kind of, you know, tender hearted that they have, this kind of great affection that the female enjoy it. They can do the let's say education of the children, raising of the children, and these ideas which are related to the nature of woman. Okay. I want to say that of course women, they have their own job which suits, of course, again to their nature
and within Islamic law, of course. Just to add this, dear Sheikh.
Yes, they can go out and they have their own appropriate job related again to their nature, but the first idea and the first, let's say, responsibilities or of women is to have this kind of you know, family relationship and whatever related to the husband and to the children.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
So, dear Sheikh, so there are some responsibilities that women, they also have, but the first and foremost responsibility they have is raising their children, because this is the future generation, right? But what about being a religious leader? Because have we seen our religious leaders, or maraja, may God preserve them all, for the most part, their job is to make Islamic rulings and not to carry perhaps these hairy responsibilities that you've mentioned, dear Sheikh. They just write a fatwa, a verdict, and that's their job. Or is that also misunderstanding in itself?
Let's say, of course, having the fatwa and giving the verdict is one of the responsibility of jurists. Sometimes the responsibility of jurists is, as I said, to establish the Islamic government, as I mentioned. It is one of the responsibility of the, you know, jurist. And of course, they have the responsibility of judging, you know.
Right.
I want to say that giving verdict is one of the responsibility. They have to do other responsibility that I mentioned. So you can guess why women and why female cannot be a major. Of course, the female can be mujtahida, which means the qualified jurist, and to practice according to her independent understanding.
Right.
Okay, and ijtihad. But being a marja, which means that other people following that specific lady, that woman cannot be in that position, because the same story is here, happening here, because that lady cannot deal with whatever related to the responsibility of marja that I mentioned that. It means that judging, giving verdict, and sometimes establishing a government. I want to say, if you look at to have a comprehensive look at the responsibility of jurists, you find it out very clearly that lady cannot be a marja.
Right. Could another reason, dear Sheikh, be that if a woman, she became a religious leader or a political leader and so on and so forth, we know that requires a lot of time and work and should be absent from her children and family, which is her primary and first responsibility.
Yes, of course. This is one of the philosophy of that, yes?
Right.
And, you know, a marja has to deal with people, go to the public, give lectures.
They come, they visit, they ask, yes. They see him, and that is not appropriate for a woman.
Yes, yes. But what is appropriate for the Muslim woman and for all female, actually, is to be, you know, in a decent life, you know, away from non-mahram, and, of course, do her responsibility according to Islamic laws.
May we, inshallah, be granted this tawfiq in our Islamic ummah, that our Muslim men and women, they both they adhere to the Islamic hijab and rulings, dear Sheikh.
Inshallah.
Sheikh, I thank you for your time today. I would love to continue this discussion. It has been very fruitful, but we are out of time, unfortunately. So I thank you yet again for joining us, and also thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in. Until next time, fi amanillah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Li Aliyin wa Husayn wa Hasan. Li Aliyin wa Husayn wa Hasan. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن علي
Economic divide.
The economy of Palestine, the land of Palestine, is being choked due to the Israeli occupation. And when COVID-19 hit, it was not kind to either. Israel's economy nosedived and is having a hard time getting back on its feet. If only the Palestinian suffocation was eased and Palestine was given a chance to prosper. The economy of Palestine and Israel, the subject of this edition of Economic Divide. Coming up in today's program, Israeli economy was hit bad by COVID-19, 2.4% contraction. GDP increase for 2022 predicted. But the businesses are reporting losses. Why is there such a contradiction there? Then, taking a look at Palestine's economy, it continues to suffocate due to the Israeli siege. COVID-19 also has had a major negative impact. The UN saying that piecemeal approach is not efficient when it comes to analyzing and approaching the Palestinian economy. And finally, Israeli occupation in terms of what it has done. It has actually damaged the economic standing of Israel, so much so that even Israelis are fleeing Israel. Israel, an apartheid regime, consequential for the Israeli economy. It is reported that Israel's economy has rebounded strongly from the COVID pandemic. The Bank of Israel optimistically predicted that the Israeli gross domestic product would grow 5% in 2022. The economy did register an 8.2% growth last year and is on track to reach 5.5% for the year 2022. Yet, this is called a COVID-19 bounce back, which is not a sign of sustained economic growth. Let's not forget the COVID-19 pandemic caused a 2.4% contraction in Israel's economy in 2020. It was the first time that the Israeli economy, which grew 3.4% in 2019, shrank since the year 2002. And Israel is again in the grips of an Omicron wave. Some industries are hit hard, like tourism. The job market, however, has bounced back far more quickly than economists had expected. Last April, the Bank of Israel warned that consumer prices would climb faster than what was expected. The economy of Israel has its downfalls like many economies around the world, yet it falls pale to the amount the economy receives due to the political repercussions of the occupation, while at the same time the occupation preventing the advancement of the Palestinian economy. Now here are some of the online views on this. First of all, did you know that Israel actually did not have a budget until very recently? Israel's central bank urged to meet the looming budget deadline, says this entry. This was a result of a prolonged political stalemate. No budget had been ratified in more than 3.5 years. Israel has since been running with a prorated version of the 2019 budget, something economists say was hindering growth. And it was only in November of 2021, after more than 3 years, Israel finally had a budget. Dr. Alex Komen, an economic expert at Tel Aviv University, actually broke down the milestone event.
Hallelujah. We've had 3.5 years without a budget, which means that money was handed out in something that was called boxes. Whenever there was a problem, there was a specific donation, and which means that the public had no way of criticizing or crystallizing an opinion about whether expenses were right or wrong or whatever.
So how Israel was actually making payouts or conducting a ledger is beyond anyone's accounting imagination. Now Israel is facing a dire economic fate of another kind. The cabinet of Prime Minister Naftali Bennett is on the verge of collapse. This comes after the Arab-Israeli party threatened to leave the ruling coalition over recent clashes that happened in Al-Quds. Now forget the hype about Israel being a miracle, blooming cutting-edge economy, as it's been described. Israel exists and prevails due to huge subsidies from the U.S. taxpayer. Israel would collapse in a nanosecond if these subsidies were withdrawn. Well, here is one example of the subsidy that was mentioned, courtesy of the U.S. Israel is the largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid in the world. They actually offer their citizens complete healthcare coverage paid for by the U.S. tax dollars, while Palestinians die on a daily basis because they are unable to access healthcare in the occupied territories, much less pay for it, if you can believe that. All right, joining us for this segment of the Q&A is Hindi Khoury, a former Minister of Affairs for Al-Quds. Hindi Khoury, welcome. Taking a look at Israel's economy, the OECD and Dun & Bradstreet actually have said Israel's economy has rebounded strongly. It's actually performing better than the global average. But at the same time, we're looking at complaints that are made by business owners that they had seen a 50% drop in their revenue. I mean, we're seeing quite a bit of a divergence here in terms of what's being said.
Well, it would look like there is a divergence because Israel has, I think, been restructuring the economy to emphasize more the technology sector. Technology and the security sector has been gaining very, very strong grounds in the Israeli economy and has been leading growth. Truly, the situation has been bad for everybody, including especially small businesses. But Israel's economy is doing very well. It's very strong and very, very sustainable. Now, there is a controversy regarding the statistics, economic statistics, regarding Israel as a member of OECD, because the The poverty, the average for poverty in OECD countries is about 11%. In Israel, it's 23%. And this, the poverty is actually among Palestinians who have Israeli citizenship and some Orthodox religious Jews. And there is the controversy is there, is that what is Israel? In which borders Israel is defined? We know the borders are not defined. And while it controls the whole of historic Palestine, including the Palestinian population in the occupied territories, so a total of Palestinian population about 7 or 7.5 million, with 8 million Jewish Israelis. So again, the world has given Israel a free ride on how it introduces itself, how it defines itself, using ambiguity in these definitions. If it was to include, for example, all the Palestinians in the occupied territories, this is the area that it controls, then certainly the statistics will be way different, because the income per capita in the Palestinian territories is about $3,000, while in Israel it's $42,000. I mean, this is just one indicator.
It's time now for our info news section, where we take a look at economic news from around the world. Our first news item is on China. China's economy actually grew 4% in the final quarter of 2021. Now that expanded it to 8.1% for year on year. That's pretty good. Although it's higher than the 3.6% that was predicted for the growth, the Q4 figure at the same time is the weakest growth that the country has seen in a year and a half. So we have to wait and see how things will progress in China, especially with the fact that they are experiencing another Omicron wave. Next to Germany, and a look at the economy there. It faces a recession if the war in Ukraine actually spurs the energy ban. Now, Germany's central bank is estimating that it's going to hit the GDP output by about 5%, so a negative 5% hit there. Possibly. And an embargo on Russian coal, oil, and gas is going to lead to restrictions on power providers and industry, which are examples of why a recession is a strong possibility in that country. Moving on to the dollar standing, another hit to it, this one coming from Israel. Israel is adding the Chinese yuan to its reserves. Now, the central bank is reshuffling forex holdings, reducing the dollar and euro exposure. Israel's reasoning, we need to look at the need to earn a return on the reserves that will cover the cost of the liability. Folks, U.S.'s best friend Israel is saying the dollar is a liability. That's big. And our final story in the U.S., a rising tally of lonely deaths on the streets. More than ever, it has become deadly to be homeless in America, especially for men in their 50s and in their 60s. They are dying in record numbers in places like Los Angeles and California. Now, it's quite ironic, because this is while the U.S. has aided a little less than $4 billion to Ukraine in military aid, and that's just in the Biden presidency. So you could take that and chew on that a little bit and digest that. Well, those were the stories that we thought were important to cover for our InfoNews section.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
The occupation of the Palestinian land has brought nothing but economic misery for Palestinians, all the while costing Palestinians hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars. And that is why this is the topic of our in-depth section. Well, in order to get an idea of the economic impact on the Palestinian economy, we need to take a look at how Palestine has been divided, even though Palestinians argue against this since it is their land. They've been divided into three areas, areas A, B, and C. Area A is under full Palestinian civil and security control, as it's called. Area B is a combination of Palestinian control and joint Israeli-Palestinian control. And Area C is under Israeli control. Area C, by the way, is where the bulk of the economic activity actually happens. Now, it's time to actually get a better idea of how Palestinians, as I just alluded there, have been robbed of their land throughout the decades. In the year 1974, as an example, in terms of what Palestine was, then you move on to the UN Partition Plan of 1947. It's pretty obvious how Israel has been forcing thousands of Palestinians off their land, occupying and illegally using it to create settlements. And as you move on through the years, those are the 1967 lines. The area in green is the Palestinian control, well, Palestinian land, and then it slowly decreases until you get to present-day Israel, which Palestinian is in the green, and look how much land they have, so much less than what Israel has. And that was Trump's plan, by the way, in terms of the division that it wanted to have for Palestinians and Israel. Again, Israel, which is in the white there, on Palestinian land again, has a majority appropriated to it. Now comes the economic impact of the occupation. This is something that is obviously very important. We broke it down into the following categories. General economic growth, $1.1 billion, loss to the Palestinian economy again. Dead Sea Minerals, $918 million. Stones, another example, $241 million. Construction, $239 million. Telecommunications, tourism, added to that. And then you come up with a grand total of $3.4 billion. Now, it's very hard to obviously get figures out of the occupied territories in terms of the Palestinian economy. So the figures and the categories that we chose, respectively, are average medians. So you're looking at about a loss of $3.4 billion that has happened as a loss for the Palestinian economy. And that is not counting the Gaza Strip. Our final look on the Palestinian economy needs to include the impact of COVID-19. That has obviously had a devastating effect, as if the Palestinian economy was not doing bad enough. UN report has actually stated in 2020 the Palestinian economy contracted around 10 to 12%. That's one of the largest annual contractions since the Palestinian Authority was established back in 1994. So the major hit that Palestinians took. That includes things like 150,000 Palestinians losing their jobs and similarly large negative impacts which are expected from the present lockdown, which is still happening. So obviously the contraction there is quite major. Let's try to get an idea about an analysis on this. Joining us for this segment is David Miller. David Miller is a broadcaster and academic, and he's a former professor of political sociology at the University of Bristol. David Miller, welcome. The Palestinian economy has been strangulated, no surprise there, based on the way that the occupation has exercised itself, looking at things like illegal settlement activities, also the confiscation of Palestinian land, destruction of property, etc. And of course, you're looking at the agriculture, how it's not being given the opportunity for it to grow based on, for example, the seizure of water. With unemployment rates at record highs, how can Palestinians actually be optimistic about their future?
Well, Palestine cannot be optimistic about the future if we're talking about the status quo, if we're talking about the continued pressure on the Palestinian economy from the occupation and from the attacks on individuals and organizations inside the territories whose livelihoods are wrecked by settlers who operate completely lawlessly under the protection of the Israel Defense Forces. So the Palestinian economy such as it is, will suffer from more and more pressure from above, from the Israeli government, from below, from the Israeli settlers, and indeed supported by the IDF. And that will drive, doesn't everyone know this? That will drive more and more people into the arms of a united resurgent resistance, because no one, because people have got nothing else left.
All right, indeed. Well, Hindi Khoury, the former Minister of Affairs for Al-Quds, rejoins us here to give us her thoughts on this. Hindi Khoury, looking at the Palestinian economy, again, it's really unbelievable that they've even been able to sustain themselves and actually make a living. There's so many different violations that have led to their economy being strangled, and of course the occupation is at the heart of it. Things like minerals, the Dead Sea, mines, non-renewable natural resources, not being able to for them to reap the benefits of that. And of course, unemployment at record highs. What do Palestinians have to look forward to in their future?
I prefer not to speak in the language of optimism and pessimism, because it depends on what we do and what others do, you know, what actions and decisions are being made. If ongoing trends continue, the prospects are very bad, I think, and maybe even disastrous. We have no local economy, and this is due for a prolonged, of course, occupation, but also prolonged unemployment, continuing drop in real value of income, increased dependence on foreign aid, Israeli controls most resources, and even Palestinian decision in many ways. We have a depleted middle class. The education sector suffers. I think it's not adapting enough to new realities and new technology demands. Purchasing power is only, not only income is dropping, but purchasing power is also dropping. And we have major structural problems. You know, we have defined ourselves in the basic law as a free market economy. And where are we from freedom? And we have absolutely no control over the mobility of capital and labor.
The Palestinian economy was stagnant and the socio-economic situation was already difficult prior to the breakout of COVID-19. This was attributed to restrictions by Israel on trade movements and access, recurrent hostilities, and falling aid inflows. Despite small increase in economic growth in the first half of 2021, due to the easing of the COVID-19 containment measures, economic activity remained below its pre-COVID-19 levels, and overall growth was nearly at 3% for the year 2021. The occupied West Bank experienced a better economic recovery, but the Gazan economy contracted due to Israel's 2021 war on the Gaza Strip and the regime's restrictions and embargo on the coastal enclave. In 2021, unemployment in Gaza reached 50.2%. Chronic electricity shortages and lack of access to clean water supplies were also impacting the economy and disrupting people's daily lives.
واحنا خاشين اصلا على شهر رمضان يعني شهر انه الانسان بزيد في موضوع الطبيخ والاكل اكثر من الايام المعتاده وهيك فاحنا عم نطلع على الاحتياجات الاساسيه كلها ارتفعت مثل الدجاج الزيوت السكر الرز الامور والطحين.
It's time to have a look at the economy in the occupied territories, particularly since this is a special edition of Economic Divide. We will look at different stories to have a glimpse into both the Israeli and Palestinian economies. The title of the first piece is Tel Aviv Residents Living in Overdraft in the World's Priciest City. This is Tel Aviv. It's marked by expensive high-rises, busy highways, and also construction activity. But Tel Aviv is known for a disease that plagues many economies, and it's called inequality. Described as one of the most expensive places to live in, many Israelis can't afford to reside here. From food to clothing, prices are astronomical.
And I just visited my daughter, and I can buy anything in Manhattan, in Chelsea, or the Upper West Side for quarter of the price, which is ridiculous. I go to the supermarket and I don't believe it, the differences of prices, from vegetables to fish to everything, to toilet paper.
Time to see what Palestinians experience in their own motherland. Keep in mind that this land is theirs, occupied by Israel, and this is the type of worry they have to deal with. This is the main thoroughfare through the Wadi al-Jos area, close to Al-Quds' old city. This is lined by mechanic workshops, but the Palestinian business owners in occupied Al-Quds are worried they will be forced to shut down their shops by Israeli authorities over plans to build a vast high-tech hub in their neighborhood. Remember the Bahrain conference? It was part of the so-called deal of the century proposed by former US President Donald Trump, which, like him, failed and joined the dustbin of history. Palestinians were offered economic rewards if they accepted Israel, but many Palestinians declined that offer. Here are boxes of unsold biscuits piled up in a West Bank warehouse, a sign of the tough economic times faced by Palestinians, yet who are determined not to be wooed by Washington's economic pledges. The Palestinian owner of the West Bank warehouse refused to give in to the U.S. offer, neatly packaged in the Bahrain conference. And our final piece goes to Palestinian businessman and billionaire Munib al-Masri. Here he is, walking near a fountain outside his mansion Beit al-Palestine in Nablus. And this is how he feels about the way Israel has dealt with Palestine.
The Jewish state means we don't have anything. During Balfour 1917, he called us a non-Jewish community. We have the right to go to the mosque and the church and to rule ourselves by municipality. But we have no political right whatsoever.
That does it for my section. I hope what we compiled for you could give you an idea about Palestine, which Israel calls its own. One day, it will get liberated.
The story of Palestine and its occupation has entered a new phase, the new phase of world recognition on a massive scale. Israelis are leaving Israel due to a lack of political will of Israel to solve the Palestinian issue. Israel needs to make a choice. That choice is to give back the land of Palestine, which it will never do. Meanwhile, the status quo cannot remain. Surely the Palestinians' resolve and resistance will overcome the Israeli apartheid regime. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. Thanks so much for being with us. Your questions and comments are always welcome. Do send them to us. For me, Kavit Avayi, and the team, it's goodbye until the next program.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajum. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatihi wa barakatuh, and welcome to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. We are looking at human justice, and we are looking at it from the perspective of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, the commander of the faithful. Now, we spoke about how Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam valued justice itself, and how he stood against oppression and how he grieved with the oppressed. We want to look at the value of life from the perspective of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. Because at the end of the day, human rights itself and justice and all these concepts, they would not exist if life did not exist, or human beings, like their life, was not present at all. We live at an age where life seems to have less value by the day. We're living in a world where wars are constantly happening. People are constantly dying. There's not a day that goes by without people being bombarded by bombshells and being killed on a daily basis. And the whole world just watches and does not care at all. I mean, obviously, to be fair, not all, but the majority of the world doesn't seem to be care. In fact, when it comes to the matter of death and life, it became also a source of joy for a lot of people. Where, for example, if you look at Hollywood and the media mechanism behind it, they seem to make death sound very interesting, rather very entertaining. Because when you see all these action movies, hundreds of people get killed in it, and, you know, presumptuously or assuming that they are bad people. But people being killed, and it doesn't seem to affect us when we see so much death happening on the screen on at least movies. Even they brought that notion that life has no value in terms of making it a game for little kids. And kids, you know, they don't understand much of these things. They just want to, you know, entertain themselves. So they play these games where they're constantly killing people. As they grow older and older, life, and it has no value to them anymore, which is sad. And that's why you see an increasing amount of crime and killing happening around the world, because now we're trying to glorify the loss of life. You know, if you're looking at games, is how much people you kill, you get a lot of stars. When you watch movies, the more people get killed in an action movie, the more entertaining it is. And when you see kids and families being, their lives being torn apart by wars, it doesn't seem to affect us anymore. So pretty much, we can conclude to the fact that life itself has no value anymore. And that is very sad, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, He created humanity based on the fact that they are living creatures, and life itself is sacred in the sight of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and it needs to be preserved. Let's take a short break and then we will continue right after.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Now, going back to Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam and his universal concept of human rights. Now, Amir al-Mu'mineen, he himself has helped people to acquire their rights and made them recognize what was due to them, because a lot of people are unaware what their rights are and how to acquire them. Where he paved the way and he told them what their rights are and how they should go upon seeking it and getting it. Also, Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, he also shared their hardship with them. And he shared the hardship with the indigent and the deprived. And so that he needs to feel the value of human rights and justice from their perspective, because when a person is sitting high on his throne and far away from the people, he can't really understand the suffering of people. And that's a problem that we face today. When we look at the systems that we live under, it's oppressive systems clothing itself with democracy and freedom, where in fact all these systems fail to preserve life or human rights for its citizens and for the people of the world. So when we look at the life of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, we get to see all these principles and how he have made every effort to create a sense of belonging and a sense that every human being should be treated equally, regardless of their race, regardless of their color. He laid a new foundation through his work and through his sermons, through his eloquence, through his jurisprudence, through his social science, and so on and so forth. He laid the foundation for human rights and the value of life itself. And you get to see how Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, in many of his sermons, especially when he goes to battle, where it is Safin, where it is the camel, or where it is Nahrawan, he never initiates war, and he says, we need to come to terms and seek a peaceful outcome because I don't want be blood to be shed. Despite the fact that you guys are my enemies, despite the fact that you guys are corruptors, I don't want to shed blood. There are better ways to solve this and resolve this. So every time he would go to battle, he would send one of his men with the Quran, and he would go to the opposite army, and he says, look, we don't want to be the first to initiate war. We want to have peace. And you can read through history that the opposite army always are the ones who end up shooting arrows at the messengers of Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi and initiating war and putting Amir al-Mu'mineen in a position where he has no choice but to start a war. So the life itself was preserved in the sight of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, and he looked at it highly. Inshallah, we will look at this topic in furthermore in other episodes. So until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
teaching prophet's job. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Teaching and training means providing conditions for thriving and growing of talents and capacities in a creature. Principally, the aim of education is to construct humans. Therefore, the ultimate goal of the divine prophets was to educate mankind. They were raised by God to guide human beings towards perfection, in a bid to take them to eternal happiness in afterlife. The prophets played the role of a gardener. In view of this, teachers are the followers of prophets if they guide their students correctly. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, said, "The first teacher is God, the Exalted, who takes people out of darkness into light and, by prophets and revelation, invites people to luminosity, perfection, love, and affection. After him, it is the prophets who promote the same divine school. Their job is also teaching, and they are the teachers of humans. Their job is to train humans so that he ascends from the status of animals and reaches the status of humanity. And after them, it is the teachers who are among humans. Teacher's job is the same job of Allah and the same job of prophets." Teaching is a very great job, an important job in the Islamic culture. The Noble Quran says in verse 32 of Surah Ma'idah, "Whoever saves a life is as though he had saved all mankind." Although the verse appears to speak about physical and material life, it also implies spiritual life. In other words, saving an individual from deviation and misguidance is in fact giving him or her life. Once a man came to the fourth infallible successor of the Prophet, Imam Sajjad, peace upon him, and complained about the murderer of his father. He told the Imam that he intended to retaliate and kill the man. Imam Sajjad asked him, "Hasn't this man rendered any service to you so that you take blood money instead of killing him?" The man told the Imam that he had been his teacher for several days. Thus, Imam Sajjad, peace upon him, said, "What are you saying? The value of teaching and guiding is more than blood and retaliation." Therefore, the man renounced retaliation. Teacher is the tool for learning and acquisition of knowledge. He or she is the one who causes individuals' intellect to grow. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, said, "Indeed, Allah, the angels and the inhabitants of earth, even the ants in its home and the fish in the sea, greet teachers who teach good things to people." May 2nd has been called Teacher's Day in Iran. The naming of this day dates back to 43 years ago, when one of the great and inexhaustible teachers of this country was assassinated by the agent of terrorist groups affiliated to the U.S. and Israeli regime. The teacher was the world-known professor and great philosopher of the 20th century, Ayatollah Murtaza Mutahhari. Martyr Mutahhari was born in 1919 in Fariman City, located some 75 kilometers southeast of Mashhad. Having finished his basic studies in his hometown, he left for Mashhad to continue his education in the seminary of Mashhad. In 1927, he left for Qom to complete his Islamic studies in spite of the tyrant Reza Khan's tough fight against ulema and seminaries. Thank you.
During his 25-year stay in Qom, Ayatollah Mutahhari attended the classes of Grand Ayatollah Hussein Borujerdi, Imam Khomeini, and Allama Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Tabatabai. In 1952, he left Qom for Tehran, although he had catapulted to fame as one of the great teachers and even future hopes of Qom Seminary. The great professor of Islamic sciences, Martyr Mutahhari, started writing of books and delivering constructive speeches in various fields of Islamic and social sciences. In 1955, he held the first session of interpretation of the Quran for university students. Very soon, the young generation was absorbed to his speeches, and the incorrect view on Islam was remarkably changed through his profound but simple speeches and classes. Ayatollah Mutahhari writes, "Experience shows that whenever religion is separated from ethics, it is ethics that falls behind. None of the irreligious ethical school has been successful. For sure, religion is necessary for human ethics, at least as a support. The more religion and belief have been undermined, the more human ethics have declined. That's why we should consider extraordinary value for belief, at least as a support for ethics, if not the only guarantee for implementing it." From 1946, Martyr Ayatollah Mutahhari authored valuable books in different fields of philosophy, social sciences, ethics, Islamic jurisprudence, Islamic history, education, and so on. More than 70 works were published from him. The most important feature of these works is that they focus on daily issues of society and answer many ambiguities and questions that were frequently asked by youth and families. His books and speeches were highly welcomed by university students and professors and intellectuals. Some of his works were published during his life, while others were published after his martyrdom. 43 years after the martyrdom of this great teacher of the 20th century, his name and fame has transcended countries and continents, and the scores of his books have been translated into several languages. This great teacher had said before his martyrdom, "If I am to lose my life in the way of preventing perversion in Islam, let it be so, as this is the best kind of death."
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.